to France's voters on April 24th. Romain Mazahari, Paris.
On Friday, tens of thousands of nurses and non-medical health professionals walked off their job and staged a nationwide strike demanding improved pay and better nurse-to-patient ratios. The industrial action had been called by a number of healthcare unions in response to the government's inaction that had followed another strike called in January. Italy's nurses have been celebrated as heroes for treating desperately ill coronavirus patients, often with little equipment and knowledge of the illness. However, today they feel forgotten. About 450,000 nurses are currently employed in Italy, a country with a population of about 60 million people. According to a recent OECD report, the average gross annual salary for nurses is among the lowest in Europe, while the ratio between nurses and the population is 6 per 1,000 inhabitants, against 18 in Switzerland and Norway, 13 in Germany and 11 in France.
The pandemic has further shown that a shortage of nurses is greatly affecting Italy's healthcare system. Nurses are exhausted today. They had to go through insurmountable challenges during the COVID crisis, including the lack of appropriate gear, knowledge, and the high number of patients. Also, some mismanagement on the part of the hospital administrations made things harder. In some regions where hospitals are run mostly by private companies, the healthcare system has collapsed catastrophically because of the COVID.
Privatized and commercialized, Italy's healthcare system has been thrown upside down over the past 20 years. A system in which private and public clinics compete for taxpayers' money came into play in 1997 when Rome opted to decentralize the Italian healthcare system and give more autonomy to regional governments. Lombardy is one of the Italian regions where the healthcare private sector is largely supported by public funding. It was also one of the worst hit regions in Europe by COVID-19 and the epicenter at the beginning of the European outbreak. Experts believe that Lombardy's fragmented healthcare system snarled the lines of command across the region, throwing hospitals into chaos. That caused the deaths of thousands of people during the first wave of COVID in Italy. Max Civili, Rome.
As voters go to the first round presidential polls this weekend, many French Muslims no longer see Emmanuel Macron as the centrist which he claimed to be in 2017. If Nicolas Sarkozy introduced Islamophobia and François Hollande made it acceptable to the mainstream, Macron's term institutionalized Islamophobia. Macron immediately took Hollande's multi-year state of emergency and legalized it, with Muslims the clear targets and practically the only victims. His so-called anti-separatist law of 2021 tried to ban the hijab for minors and clearly violated constitutional protections for the freedom of association, worship, and politics. It was so heavy-handed, even the United Nations and English language media widely criticized it.
Emmanuel Macron lance son projet sur le séparatisme.
When Macron launched his anti-separatism law, which hurt Muslims so badly, it was a clear bid to join the far right. We saw that he was using their same ideas and preferred methods, and that he was doing it in broad daylight.
In the months preceding the election, nearly 100 mosques have been raided, with at least 24 shut down so far. Top Muslim NGOs and local community centers have also been exiled or closed. A new report revealed that these closures were based merely on secretive evidence, which is to say no evidence was ever produced in court.
Sur la radicalisation, on a entendu de tout et n'importe quoi.
His government has produced so much nonsense, like when they said having a beard was a sign of being a radical Muslim or taking Ramadan seriously. His politics are clearly identity politics, and that's a real danger. His objective is to have a seat at the table with the other far-right politicians.
Not apologizing for massacres during the war against Algerian independence, keeping the Arab Nelson Mandela, Georges Ibrahim Abdullah, in prison, enacting legislation which falsely equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. gutting social services and help for poor, largely immigrant areas. Many Muslims say they are prepared to vote against Macron in the second round, whomever the candidate. In 2012, 93% of over 2 million Muslim voters picked Hollande over Sarkozy, providing the decisive margin in an extremely tight contest. In 2022, Muslims may play a similar role of kingmaker, but it's still not sure which side they will pick. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
After an hours-long manhunt throughout Tel Aviv, Israeli forces clashed with Raad Hazem and killed him in Yaffa. 28-year-old Raad Hazem from Jenin refugee camp in the north of the occupied West Bank was the Palestinian man who opened fire in Dezengov shopping street in central Tel Aviv Thursday night, killing two Israelis and wounding nine others. The Palestinian resistance groups praised the operation, describing it as heroic. Hamas resistance groups said it proves resistance is continuing and escalating, while the Islamic Jihad said the operation confirmed how fragile the Israeli regime is.
The assassination of any Palestinian, Tel Aviv's crimes, and aggression on Al-Aqsa Mosque is responded by more heroic operations. So it's a natural and legitimate response. Israel must expect that any future steps or crimes would definitely drag such reactions.
Following the operation, more than 1,000 police officers joined a manhunt, while the Israeli settlers were ordered to get off the streets and remain at home. Experts say the operation that was the latest string of deadly operations across the occupied territories and the fourth in 2.5 weeks had confused the Israeli regime and proved its weakness.
This operation in particular has really shocked the Israeli society, and the Israeli regime is broken on all levels, even the security level, because they deal with the Palestinian as a security problem and not people having political and historic rights. This operation is telling them that Palestinians exist as real owners and they have a right in these lands.
Meanwhile, Israeli military has declared its forces will be on high alert in Al-Quds for the first Friday prayers of the holy month of Ramadan. The Israeli police bolstered their forces in Al-Quds, and more troops have stationed on the numerous checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, imposing more strict measures against the Palestinians. Palestinians say the Israeli military thought its crackdown and aggression following the March 22nd operation that claimed four Israeli lives led to a state of calm in the occupied territories. However, Raad Hazem's Thursday attack that killed two more Israelis reminded the regime that the entire Palestinian lands are occupied and that the resistance continues. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
One of the men is Britain's monarch in waiting. The other is one of the UK's most prolific paedophiles and abusers, a public figure who used his influence to groom and attack on suspecting victims. Big question I get asked. Now in a series of bombshell revelations being made in a new Netflix series, the handwritten correspondence between 1986 to 2006 shows Prince Charles asking the late Saville for tips in repairing the reputation of the royals. Experts argue that the prince was duped like so many others, but even without the benefit of hindsight, Charles's association with Saville seems surprising.
It's remarkable that they didn't call upon the services of a professional PR company and they sought the services of Jimmy Savile. It just goes to show the lack of judgment and the lack of understanding of the potential for this kind of blowback when they cavort with these celebrities not knowing anything about their background or not even trying to look into their background before they do so. We are talking about the royal family after all, aren't we?
These new revelations, albeit of a past association, adds to the woes of an institution already struggling with the fallout from the Meghan Markle-Prince Harry union, Prince Andrew reaching a multi-million pound settlement for allegations he had sex with an underage girl, and outstanding accusations that Prince Charles's former associate exchanged financial inducements for helping a Saudi millionaire with his British papers.
This new revelation is something the royal family could well do without at a time when the House of Windsor is scrambling to repair its image and reputation after a series of very public missteps. The association between one of the most prolific abusers in history and the heir to the throne is a serious blow.
As Queen Elizabeth scales back on her public duties, Prince Charles must now try and convince an uncertain public the crown will be safe in his hands. On this evidence, at least, the jury is out. Amina Taylor, London.
Just days after a UN-backed truce came into force in Yemen, fears have risen over the implementation of the agreement, with key promises regarding commercial flights being allowed to enter Sana'a's international airport failing to materialize so far. At the time of the UN announcement, senior Yemeni officials warned onlookers to remain cautious about raising their hopes prematurely. Despite the warning, many Yemenis have already become excited for an end to the war.
The truce is wonderful for us and the region in general, a great thing. And we hope that the truce will last not only for 2 months, but rather permanently, because the people are tired and they have suffered a lot.
Yemenis have faced their fair share of disappointment over the years in regards to peace efforts. Multiple nationwide ceasefires have all failed, and the 2018 peace talks hosted by Sweden also failed to produce an end to the conflict. However, experts still believe the flights will begin soon.
The truce is holding very well. Reports of violations do not amount to breaking the truce. It's the usual standard violations that take place in similar situations. The Saudis have been trying to get out of this quagmire for a long time. And the big major conference in Riyadh is their way to initiate the exit out of the Yemen conflict. So I'm very hopeful that this will lead to some major break in the Yemeni conflict.
This truce, which the United Nations is already celebrating, could turn into a curse rather than a blessing for millions of Yemenis if key pledges regarding the siege are not upheld. In particular, so many will be hoping that they can finally get into Yemen to visit their besieged loved ones. If that turns out not to be the case, then it would be another additional heartbreak on top of the many already broken hearts which have been caused by this devastating conflict. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's nuclear energy program has redefined the country's domestic and foreign policies since the country indigenized the industry. Every year on April 9th, Iran showcases the latest nuclear achievements to mark National Nuclear Technology Day. With President Ebrahim Raisi in attendance, the ceremony this year saw the unveiling of 9 new products out of a total of 77 pieces of nuclear-related equipment produced recently. The president boasted that Iran's nuclear advances were made while the country was under Western pressure.
They didn't want us to have our own domestic nuclear industry. They tried their best to stop us. They assassinated our nuclear scientists. They imposed sanctions and even targeted our nuclear facilities with explosions. But here we are treading our path toward greater success in the nuclear industry.
Today, we have extended our nuclear know-how to an extent that we can use it in a range of industries such as agriculture and health, such as radio medicine. We will generate 10,000 megawatts of nuclear-powered electricity and are planning to build an entirely domestic 360-megawatt nuclear power plant.
The event comes as Iran and the world powers are wrapping up talks over the revival of the 2015 deal, which promised Tehran sanctions relief in return for curbs on its nuclear program. The accord has faced trouble since the U.S. unilaterally left it in 2018 and reinstated anti-Iran sanctions. That prompted Iran and other signatories to the accord to launch the Vienna talks to fix the ailing deal.
You know, we have already finished the discussions and negotiation there. As you have heard from our foreign minister, it is time for decision. They have to make difficult decision. That depends, of course, to them to decide if really they want to come back to the deal. This is the Americans that they have to decide. Of course, we are working in an organization dealing with technical issues, not with political issues. But we are looking forward to see that if there is a deal there, then we will implement the deal based on our obligations.
Iran designated April 9th as the Nuclear Technology Day back in 2006, when the country enriched uranium on an industrial scale for the first time. Since then, the country has seen a steady progress in the sector, from building nuclear power plants to centrifuges and radiopharmaceuticals. So Nuclear Technology Day is seen as an occasion for the country to reaffirm its right to a peaceful nuclear energy program.
Sanctions have been haunting Iran's nuclear program since the country indigenized the key sector. Tehran calls the sanctions illegal and unfair, for it has insisted before the conclusion of the 2015 deal, up until now when the Vienna talks are underway, that weapons of mass destruction have no place on the Islamic Republic's agenda, and that its nuclear program is totally civilian. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Jenin in the occupied West Bank has been the scene of Palestinian deaths. Another Palestinian succumbed to his wounds, raising the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since Sunday to 4. Why are Israeli forces given the free hand to kill Palestinians in such a manner? And is a full-scale and major confrontation with the occupying Israeli regime ready to spark at any time? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking our guests in this edition of The Spotlight.
There is no end in sight to the Israeli atrocities against Palestinians in the occupied territories. The regime has intensified its brutal tactics across the West Bank and Al-Quds over the past few weeks, killing and injuring dozens and arresting scores more during their raids. However, Palestinians this time have resorted to retaliatory operations targeting Israelis in Tel Aviv and its suburbs. Tensions escalated after an Israeli decision to expand the settler units on the occupied land. That prompted more retaliatory operations in different cities. With more than 7 decades of occupation and the regime's defiance of UN resolutions and international laws, many believe a new era of Palestinian resistance has just begun.
Naturally, that was the response of our youngsters who has waited more than 30 years for the international community to move and to stop those crimes of Israeli and those atrocities of Israeli army against our children and our nation. Today, these missions and these operations, they are the actual response to those who are talking about normalization of relation with Israel, that criminal regime who has to be punished rather not to be rewarded with this normalization.
Palestinian resistance groups, including Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, have already hailed the operations against the regime. They have also vowed that the Israeli rampage would not go unanswered. Tensions have been growing ever since Israel embarked on the process to normalize ties with several Arab states, including Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Morocco. Palestinians describe the process a stab in their back. To add to the fuel further, Israel recently hosted a summit of foreign ministers of these Arab governments, as well as Egypt and the United States in the occupied Negev Desert. But will such a policy ever benefit Israel while it continues cracking down on Palestinians and ignoring their rights of survival?
So it'll be interesting to see how their own peoples treat this alliance. I think the clock is ticking on these countries in terms of their own street, their own masses, and I think revolution is just around the corner.
The regime's cruel policies, including its provocations at Islam's third holiest site in Al-Quds, as well as fatal shootings of innocent Palestinians, prove that it has never been in favor of peace. Now, it has tightened its grip on the cities of Jenin and Al-Khalil. Over a dozen Palestinians, including women and children, have been killed in the past 2 weeks. Palestinians say they have no other option but to resist the Israeli occupation and crimes it's been committing almost on a daily basis. It seems the normalization deals and bloody crackdowns have backfired, putting Israel at an unprecedented risk instead of ensuring its security.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, International Coordinator, Samuddin Palestinian Prisoners to Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, joins us from Vancouver. Also joining us, activist and commentator Nick Napier joins us from Edinburgh.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Charlotte Cates. I'm looking just at what has occurred. Another Palestinian to have succumbed to his wounds today Jenin, and you have basically the number of Palestinians killed since Sunday to 4 in what appears to be a free hand given to the Israeli security forces to do what they want, pretty much, just a green light coming from the prime minister.
Absolutely. I mean, what we're seeing is an attempt to crush the ongoing Palestinian resistance, particularly targeting Jenin and Jenin camp. It's a resistance that has never been destroyed. And it's important to note that we're actually looking at the 20th anniversary of the previous massive assault on Jenin camp by the Israeli occupation, the Great Battle of Jenin, which was an occasion of vast atrocities committed by the Israeli occupation. And then there's a film called Jenin Jenin, which portrays these very factually in a very moving way. But it also is a site of great resistance, and of a resistance that despite normalization, despite Oslo, despite the Palestinian Authority, and despite massive imprisonment and targeting against the Palestinian resistance, has never been crushed. And so what we're seeing in this assault that's taking place in Jenin, in this wholesale killing and execution of Palestinian civilians as well as resistance fighters, I mean, for example, we saw them taking the lives of children as well as the lives of a nearly blind woman simply attempting to cross the street just yesterday, that in addition to these massive crimes that are taking place against the Palestinian people, what we are also seeing in Jenin is the fact that Palestinian resistance has not yet been killed despite 74 years of Nakba and cannot be killed. And so Jenin is not just a symbol of destruction, but also a symbol of the fact that Palestinians resistance continues to uphold humanity in the face of all kinds of violence that is backed up by the most powerful regimes and states in the world, and that all those, particularly in the Western countries whose governments are continuing to provide aid and support, including military aid and deals with the Israeli regime, take action, build the boycott, come into the streets to stand with the Palestinian people in Jenin, in Gaza, throughout occupied Palestine from the river to the sea, sure, and their resistance.
I'm sifting through some of the deaths that have occurred here, McNabb here. One of them stands out, which is not reported that widely, no surprise there, and that's about the person by the name of Sanad, 16 years old, Israeli forces shooting this person in the chest with live ammunition as he approached a Palestinian man who had been shot to offer aid. This would be the fifth Palestinian child shot and killed by Israeli forces for this year, which gives credence to what the Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has said, who has said there will not be any limits for this war. We are granting full freedom of action to the army, the Shin Bet, and all security forces. Some are rightly concluding, if you agree, with that being a green light for Israeli forces to kill, including extrajudicial killings. Do you agree?
I only have one slight disagreement. The Israeli killing of Palestinians is permanently barbaric. I mean, the United Nations Human Rights Council, during the Great March of Return, published a report saying that it was a very blunt report. They said that Israeli snipers were killing health workers, journalists, and children, knowing that they were journalists and health workers and children. So this is not so much a green light as a call to intensify the repression. They've always had a green light. I mean, a group called Breaking the Silence, Israeli soldiers, they're quite many ways. But the story of occupation forces do Palestinians barbaric. One is when bored at a checkpoint, each of them, Palestinian man to the ground, strangle him, throttle him. And the one who's Palestinian the longest time to be wins this. Now, this is public knowledge. And the killing of journalists, of not just, but the killing of
Israeli
military.
I'm going to unfortunately jump in here. We're getting you broken up. The audio connection is not working right. So we'll give the tech people a little bit of time to fix that before I come back to you. Charlotte Cates, it was very surprising to hear another statement coming from Naftali Bennett. This comes after what happened in Tel Aviv, which was called a heroic action of a resistance operation that was executed. He said that now Israel is moving from a state of self-defense to a state of attack. Now, you know, when you hear that, it goes against what we know Israel is doing on the ground, which is basically violating Palestinian rights. And it seems like they are always on the offensive. Why is it that Israel thinks that, and then you have either the U.S. or the European Union or allies of Israel that actually believe that, at least that's what they're showing the world? What do you think about the statement made there by Naftali Bennett?
Well, of course, I mean, it's laughing in the face of reality. It's a complete slap in the face to any look at reality, which is that it's impossible for Israel, so-called Israel, to ever be engaged in self-defense. Because the fact is that the Israeli regime is built on the dispossession and destruction and attempted destruction of the Palestinian people from their land. It's a fundamentally illegitimate project. There is no such thing as legitimate self-defense of the colonizer to keep its colonial regime intact. Instead, it is the fact that people who are living under colonization and people who are living under occupation have the right to resist, have the right to struggle for freedom. And so this is exactly what we're seeing take place. Now, it is certainly true that the resistance is exposing the fact that this facade, this mirage of so-called Israeli security, the fact is that all of these billions of dollars of high-powered surveillance and spy technology that Israel makes more billions of dollars marketing to repressive regimes around the world, including its imperialist partners in crime in the United States, the UK, Canada, and Europe, that all of this so-called security technology cannot stop an indigenous people from continuing to resist, continuing to fight back, continuing to seek freedom despite all odds, and that it is only bringing an end to injustice, something that the Israeli regime never wants to do, that actually can bring about real peace and justice.
Very well. Mick Knapp here, if you want to continue with where you left off, you can do that, unless you want me to ask you another question.
No, that's okay. I think that anyone who looks at a map of Palestine since 48 can see that not a day goes by or a month or a week without Israel stealing more land. And the founding fathers of Zionism were very clear, Jabotinsky, for example, that this could only be achieved by tremendous violence, that there's no example in the history of the world of a native people giving up their homeland to invaders, to colonizers, without resistance. And the greater the resistance, the greater the violence that needs to be to them. So it's very difficult actually to say something new when there's a new atrocity, except to say this, that the more the Palestinians resist, the greater will have to be the horror of the Zionist project. And we've seen report after damning report, they're endless. Every few years we get one that says Israel's a barbaric state, which is committed to the dispossession of all the native people and driving them into Jordan or somewhere else, and replacing them with Zionist Jews from around the world. And when the Palestinians resist, they are resisting colonialism. I mean, what is colonization? It's naked violence. It's an anachronism. After the great anti-colonial movements of the end of the 20th century, Israel is out of time. There's no other project, perhaps with the exception of Myanmar, where the Rohingya Muslims are being expelled, are being driven from their homeland. And by the way, the UN has recently described that activity as genocide. Nothing the Myanmar junta has done to the Rohingya Muslims has not been done by Israel to the Palestinians. If you call one genocide, and we should, then what Israel's doing to the Palestinians is a kind of slow motion genocide as well. So the resistance is not just supported by the Geneva Convention. It's supported by any ethical system in the history of the human race. The right to resist this brutal regime which Zionism consists of. There is no subtlety in what the Zionists do. It is the application of violence. It's the application of greater violence whenever that produces resistance. And they have been very consistent about that. And, you know, if the Palestinians seek a legal way out of it, Donald Trump said if anyone dared to take Israel to the International Criminal Court or the International Court of Justice, America would apply tremendous sanctions against them. And Europe complied with that. So the Palestinians have won legal decisions. It's just over 12 years ago, the Israeli apartheid wall was ruled by one of the international courts to be a crime. And every Western government which subscribed to the court was instructed to take action to support the Palestinians, to have the wall dismantled and to seek restitution. What did Britain and the other states do? Increased their arms sales to Israel. So the Palestinians have tried everything. The resistance needs to be supported. There are many ways to resist. For some people, it's the heroism of armed resistance. But there are many forms of resistance, popular resistance, across the West Bank and across 1948 Gaza. So that resistance has a call upon our solidarity. If they did not resist, it would be pathological. It would be something shameful.
All right. Let's break down this entry with you, Charlotte Cates, because it cleverly wants to portray a scenario about Palestinians. And I'm going to read through it. It reads, "The current surge in terrorist attacks, as it calls it, in Israel, has been framed by Palestinian parties and militant groups as a logical consequence of the entrenchment of Israel's 55-year occupation of the West Bank and of Israel's control over sensitive religious sites." And it goes on and on. Now, the thing here is it calls what happened in Israel, that terrorists are doing that. It calls Palestinian militant groups. But at the same time, it's acknowledging that there is a point that has been broken by the Palestinians in terms of how the rights are being obviously violated. What do you think of that? Do you think that there is an acknowledgement, but yet Palestinians are still being accused of what's happening?
Well, it is certainly the case that the United States government and the mainstream corporate media and other imperialist powers, they are fully and fundamentally aware of the reality of what the Zionist project is. They are not under the impression that it is something other than an illegitimate apartheid racist settler colonial project. But it has always been the case of those who hold power unjustly and through colonization and exploitation and oppression of others, that all of those who fight back against that colonization and oppression and exploitation are deemed terrorists. And of course, this is a term when terror is far more aptly applied to the monumental and monstrous state violence that is constantly visited upon the indigenous people of Palestine who are struggling to retain their land and return to their land despite 74, not 55 years of occupation, colonization, and Nakba. There has been an attempt to obscure that reality from the eyes of people around the world. And this is certainly an attempt in which all of these imperialist governments and the corporate mainstream media have been fully complicit. But when people can simply turn on their computers and see for themselves, despite all the censorship taking place on social media platforms, see from Palestinians the reality of life under occupation and colonization and the reality of Israeli brutality and barbarism, that people cannot be lied to anymore. And so there is sort of this acknowledgement of this reality, but an attempt to suppress that resistance that seeks to bring that horrendous reality to an end by all means. And so it's really important that we stand against this classification of Palestinian resistance as terrorism. In fact, there's been an attempt to expand the scope of terrorism, where even doing so much as advocating for Palestinian farmers to maintain their land and representing Palestinian political prisoners in Israeli military courts is being labeled as terrorist activity as well. The real terror is that which is created by imperialism and Zionism, and the Palestinian resistance is a justified, legitimate force that all people who care about justice should support.
Sure. Mick Napier, the attacks that happened, the two most recent attacks in Tel Aviv and another one in an area by the name of Bray Brak, they were carried out by Palestinians from the occupied West Bank. No claim of responsibility at this point. And you have Palestinian groups that have not claimed responsibility. And based on a senior military official of Israel, he said that no evidence that this was masterminded by a major Palestinian group, which then leads one to maybe conclude, if you think, that the level of occupation has reached such epic proportions that it is leading maybe Palestinians who are not affiliated to anybody to just go out and commit such acts. Do you think that it has reached that level?
Well, yes. When you put people in such a pressure cooker, when every Palestinian who approaches a checkpoint depends upon the mood of a lance corporal or a sergeant or anybody in an Israeli uniform, whether he or she will be allowed to proceed to their work, to go to their family, to go to a clinic, or will be detained for 3 or 4 hours, or will be turned back and denied something that they need. When this life is forced upon Palestinians, where the lowest soldier at the checkpoint is simply there to humiliate and takes every opportunity to humiliate, then resistance is inevitable. Because Palestinians, unlike Algerians or unlike Vietnamese, live in a terrible prison, completely surrounded by Israel, controlling every entry point, and it really is a gigantic prison. In that situation, Israel has tremendous power. It has fantastic surveillance. It can blackmail Palestinians to become collaborators. You want to have your mother be allowed to go to a hospital for a life-saving operation? Become a collaborator. We have something that you'd be very embarrassed about. Become a collaborator or we'll tell your neighbors. So in that situation, the ability of the Israelis to infiltrate, to understand, to be able to subvert coherent resistance movements, it's not perfect, but it's very great indeed. Mm-hmm. And therefore, individual Palestinians sometimes just reach a breaking point when they cannot organize collectively, they will strike out individually. And it's absolutely inevitable. By the way, the Israelis know it's inevitable. This talk of terrorism is just a mask. And you know, I'm reminded of every single anti-colonial movement has been designated as terrorist, as savage, as barbaric, and every possible invective is hurled against them. The reality is that it's an anti-colonial movement. It's noble. It's just. And all the decent people of the world, I mean all, actually support the Palestinians. They may be majorities in some places and large minorities in others, but they support the Palestinians. Okay. And look at who's lined up with the Israelis. It really doesn't bear examination. Can I just say one thing? I'm reminded of the Spanish conquistador, Castellanos. He said of the people in the Caribbean, "We call them cannibals." It comes from the word Carib. "We call them cannibals because they defend their villages very strongly and they refuse to be enslaved." So the Palestinians are called terrorists? Of course they are. But Israel is a terrorist state. And you know something? When the European Union is forced to apologize to Israel for the opinions of its citizens, we know what side we're on. And Israel knows it's in a crisis. If I just say one more thing, the Palestinians, through their struggle, have already won a crucial battle against Israel. Israel is deeply unpopular worldwide. And that's why the BDS movement is able to grow and will continue to grow in line with and parallel with Palestinian resistance.
Thank you for that. From Edinburgh, Mick Napier, their activist and commentator. Charlotte Cates, thank you for your insight. From Vancouver, international coordinator, Samu Samidoun, Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, who gave us her insight. Okay, that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway and the entire team, is goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, it was said that Imam Khomeini led a very simple life, and his wife, Khadija Saghafi, also accompanied him in tough economic conditions. Today we are going to hear the rest of the story from Ms. Saghafi. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini resided in Yakhchal Ghazi neighborhood of Qom in 1943. This was his 8th house, and the Imam lived there for nearly 20 years. His wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, relates the story as follows. In 1943, we entered the house in Yakhchal Ghazi. It was in this house that Mustafa and the 3 daughters married. Dear listeners, it was in this house that Imam Khomeini broadened his struggles seriously against the despotic Pahlavi regime. In those days, the Imam delivered his fiery and historical speech against capitulation bill, which would grant judicial immunity to the U.S. advisors in Iran, even if they committed a heinous crime. The Imam's wife continues, "It was this Yakhchal Ghazi neighborhood that we left for Najaf Ashraf in 1965 and never came back again. It was this house that turned into the center of struggles of ulema in Iran. It was here that the Imam's historical speech against capitulation was delivered, and it was here that the first seeds of the Imam's movement yielded fruit and the June 5, 1963 uprising was created. It was this house that was assaulted by the Savak from time to time, and all belongings of Imam Khomeini were pillaged in one of these assaults. Those who were in contact and commutation with this house were sent to exile to cities and villages, one after the other. The stories of this house are the stories of the revolution, and this house can be called the center of Imam Khomeini's movement in the real sense of the word." Imam Khomeini and his wife loved books and book reading. Thus, they attached high importance to education and studying. Ms. Khadija Saghafi took advantage of her marital life and used Imam Khomeini as a teacher for religious studies. She says, "I was in the 8th grade when I married. After marriage, I started studying Jamul Muqaddamat, the book which is taught to fresh students of seminaries as the basic source of higher courses with him. However, I wouldn't study as a free student, but while doing house chores and looking after children and commutation with friends. Yet, I didn't give up studying despite all these hardships till the birth of my fourth child, who was very unquiet and sick and had made me busy around the clock. I had no time for studying. In those days, I was studying Lum'e, the book for middle grades of seminaries, while Mr. Ruhullah had 7 courses from morning till evening. Therefore, I gave up studying. Book reading was a common habit in Imam Khomeini's house. Of course, the Imam would study more than others and was the role model in this aspect, like other aspects. He was very careful on the number of books at home and would never keep more than 200 books. The Imam had most of the reference books. Ms. Khadija, however, was interested in reading the Quran, prayer books, and novels. Thus, she had studied famous novels like Les Misérables of Victor Hugo and War and Peace of Leo Tolstoy. She had read the books of Iranian novelists and writers like Jalal al-Ahmad and Dr. Shariati too. Imam Khomeini and his wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, had composed some poems. Imam Khomeini had composed 80 pieces of lyrics before marriage, but they were lost during changing houses. However, he composed some other lyrics after marriage. Ms. Saghafi relates, as he says, he had composed 80 lyrics before our marriage, when his belongings were brought from Darush Shafa School. All books were there except the book of his poems. We couldn't find it. After marriage, he would travel alone for a while. And as he had a poetic talent, he started composing poems again, which were almost 70 lyrics. I had collected them because I loved poems very much. I wouldn't read poems like others. I would rather touch poems and would shiver and shed tears while reading them. This poetic talent and love of poems in Imam Khomeini's family caused Ms. Khadija Saghafi's talent to flourish too. The life hardships would take much of her time, but the separation from the Imam caused her to compose a few lines. She says in this regard, "I loved learning, but our house had become the place of commutation of relatives and friends. Thus, there was no time for studying. When Mr. Khomeini was sent to exile to Turkey, I composed a few lyrics, panegyrics and quatrains. I was not, and I am not, a poetess, but what said as a poem, I will never forget as it is related to the time of separation from the Imam." Composition of lofty poems by Imam Khomeini, in which he had dealt with Gnostic issues, had upset some sanctimonious people in seminaries. They even called for expelling the Imam, as he had used words like wine and tavern in his poems. For your information, dear listeners, it should be said that such words have completely different connotations in Farsi poetry. They have nothing to do with intoxication and the common wine and related issues. Therefore, the first personality in the Qom seminary
and the source of emulation, late Grand Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim Ha'ir Yazdi, had strongly supported Imam Khomeini, as he was a renowned clergyman and a great teacher of seminaries.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.